Okay. Thank you very much, and thank you all for coming so early in the morning. I'm gonna tell you about some work done in collaboration with a bunch of people here from Station Q, some of whom are here, some of whom are stuck, one of whom is stuck in Argentina, apparently. If you have any really difficult questions, just find someone else in the audience to ask them to, okay? Let me start a little slowly by saying, you know, we are now at this point used to exotic statistics, or some of us are used to exotic statistics in two dimensions, which arises because if you follow Feynman's prescription for computing the quantum mechanical amplitude for a system of particles, which at some initial time t are at some positions x1, x2, x3, and you want the amplitude for them to be at the same position, say, at some later time t prime, then what you should do is just sum over all possible histories for these particles to go from those initial positions to those final positions. The only thing you have to do is you have to make sure to weight them, each one differently, by the exponential of the action for that history. Okay? This particular form of weighting is chosen by consistency with the classical limit, so that you compare nearby trajectories by weighing them differently by the relative phases here. I left out the h bar. If you put an is over h bar here and the h bar goes to zero limit, this gets concentrated on the extremal trajectories, which are the classical ones. Okay? Now, the special thing to two space and one time dimension is that the space of histories is disconnected. Okay? So you end up with a non-trivial configuration space for n particles. Just to give you a simple example of this, suppose we have two hardcore particles in two dimensions. Then, as far as the topology of their configuration space is concerned, the center mass degree of freedom is unimportant. Okay? So let's assume for a moment that we just have them in two-dimensional plane, and we haven't put them on a torus or anything with some interesting topology. They're just in the two-dimensional plane. The center mass degree of them is unimportant. And actually, the relative distance between them is also unimportant, so long as they have hard cores. And so let's just freeze out that degree of freedom. And so really, all you have is, let's just set them to be at a distance one from each other. Then the two-particle configuration space is just this circle, and this has non-trivial topology. It has winding numbers, or another way of saying that is that its first homotopy group is the integers. Whereas in three dimensions, if you go through the exact same exercise, forget about the center mass degree of freedom, focus solely on the relative degree of freedom, and fix the separation between the particles, you have the sphere. And of course, the famous result is that you can't lasso the sphere, so it seems there's no non-trivial topology here. Okay? Unless the particles are identical, in which case, rather than having the sphere, you have to mod out by reflections, and so there is some non-trivial topology then. To be a little more specific, if we have now n particles rather than two particles in two dimensions, then the first homotopy group of the configuration space is the Braid group, which is generated by interchanges, counterclockwise interchanges, usually denoted by sigma I, which is an interchange like this, a counterclockwise interchange between the ith and ith plus one particle, and they satisfy some relations. If those interchanges act on disparate sets of particles, okay, then they commute with each other, as you expect. But if you have interchanges on two overlapping pairs of particles, then they don't commute with each other, but they satisfy this relation, which is graphically depicted here, and just says essentially that these two crossings here, if I pull this one through, this strand through to the other side here, then you've changed the order of crossings, which is algebraically encapsulated in this equation, which is sometimes called the Young-Baxter equation. Okay. Now, in three dimensions, if the particles are identical, so one minor side is that nothing I said here requires the particles to actually be identical. This is all true, okay? Even if the particles are distinguishable. Now, if the particles were all distinguishable, then what you'd want is a subgroup of the Braid group called the pure Braid group, which requires every line to terminate at exactly the same place as it started out. But if the particles were identical, then of course the final state could be some permutation of the initial particles. Now, in 3D, if the particles are distinguishable, there's nothing interesting. But if they're identical, then you have the permutation group, okay? Which is, again, generated by primitive pairwise interchanges subject to these exact same constraints, okay, or these exact same conditions, plus one extra condition, okay, which is that each interchange, counterclockwise interchange, squares to one, okay? And that one extra condition simplifies it considerably. This is an infinite group, and this is a group with, if you have n particles, n factorial elements. Now, so it looks like there's a big difference in two dimensions and three dimensions, and of course there is. In two dimensions, the Gray group allows for the possibility of anions. So there's one-dimensional representations of the Gray group, which lead to abelian anions, which includes fermions, bosons, Laughlin quasiparticles, or the electric and magnetic charges in the toric code, for instance. And we believe, although it's a little hard to really pin down direct experimental evidence, that the fractional quantum Hall regime exhibits abelian anions, for instance, if the nu equals a third state. It's also possible to have non-abelian anions, which are higher dimensional representations of the Bray group. They basically are the following. If you have n quasiparticles at some fixed positions, there's an exponentially large set of degenerate states, so that if you were to do an exchange like this, that initial state transforms in that degenerate subspace, transforms into a different state, which you could encapsulate by a matrix. And if you did a different braid, so say instead of I and J, rather J and K, you'd get some different matrix which wouldn't necessarily commute the first one. Now, a particular type of non-abelian anion, so there's many types of non-abelian anions, a particular type which has been the focus of a lot of interest, because it seems to, or some version of it seems to be prevalent in many physical models of physical systems, including the leading candidate for the five, or the leading candidates for the five halves plateau and fractional quantum Hall regime, are associated with Majorana zero modes, are often called Ising anions. And these occur essentially when you have some kind of defect in a quantum medium, I actually shouldn't say ordered here, but in some kind of quantum medium, which support a zero energy real fermionic mode. So you have some mode which is equal to its Hermitian adjoint and satisfies a Clifford algebra like this for their anti-commutation relations, then each pair of such anions supports a two-level system like this, and you have a 2 to the n minus 1 dimensional, roughly in some sense squared of 2 dimensional Hilbert space per particle. Now, returning to the three-dimensional and higher-dimensional case, you could ask, in analogy with what we just said about the Bray group, whether the permutation group also has interesting higher-dimensional representations. It does. The only one-dimensional representations are bosons and fermions, but there are also higher-dimensional representations. However, it's been known since the early 70s that these are all boring in the following sense, which is that if you impose further the constraint that this comes out of some local physical theory, then actually there has to be this higher dimensional representation space has to be the tensor product of local Hilbert spaces associated with each particle. And so you can see, so for instance, the kind of thing you might have is you might have a 2 to the 2n dimensional representation of the permutation group of 2n particles, but really that's just 2n bosons with a local two-state system attached to each particle. Okay. With non-abelian anions in 2D, that's not the case. It's impossible to decompose that Hilbert space into a product of local Hilbert spaces. The Ising anion case is sort of misleading in this respect because it looks like it's square root of 2 dimensions per particle, which almost looks like if you're decomposing into local Hilbert spaces, although that square root of 2, of course, is the important distinction that it obviously there isn't. But in general, for instance, Fibonacci anions, it's the nth Fibonacci number, which is obviously not going to decompose in this way. So a brief summary of what I've said so far is roughly two dimensions. You can have interesting types of particles because you can have anions, possibly non-abelian. And 3D, well, it's the permutation group, so we only have bosons and fermions. Okay. So take home message, 2D good, 3D bad. Okay, so unfortunately, this simple picture was kind of, Jeff Teo and Charlie Kane are both here, took a pretty big swing at this simple picture by pointing out that they constructed this model of three-dimensional electrons. So here's an electron moving in a background of essentially fluctuating superconductivity and band mass, okay, the band mass that drives you, or a Dirac fermion mass that tunes you through between a topological and ordinary insulator in three dimensions. Okay, so by looking at a Dirac equation of this form, where this quote-unquote order parameter n combines the real and imaginary parts of the superconducting order parameter and this Dirac mass, they show that if you look at a hedgehog in this order parameter, that it has Majorana of zero modes. And once you have Majorana of zero modes, you're now perilously close to the Ising anion situation that we discussed earlier, okay? Or that I reminded you of earlier, which is that you now have a 2 to the n minus 1 dimensional Hilbert space if you have 2n of these, which means that, again, you're in this situation where you have something like a square root of 2 states per particle, okay? Which sounds like bad news from the point of view of Doppler, Hagen, Roberts' result about permutation group representations. Now, physically, this was motivated, I think, in part, by an earlier proposal of Liang Fu and Charlie Kane, in which they looked at the interface between a 3D topological insulator and an S-wave superconductor. And in this beautiful proposal of theirs, this protected surface Dirac fermion is gapped out by the superconductivity, and you can then have vortices in the superconductor and the induced superconductivity, and those vortices have zero modes. If you look at it in this picture in which we have this enlarged order parameter, then vortices in this picture are actually hedgehogs, because at the interface, the Dirac mass is zero, and you just have the winding of the superconducting order parameter, but above and below the interfaces, if you go far enough away, it's either pointing towards the north or the south pole, which is kind of the ordinary vacuum or ordinary insulating state and a topological insulator down here. So vortices in this language are hedgehogs. Now, of course, if the hedgehogs were confined to move just along this interface, then it really is back to 2D and we don't have to lose any sleep. Even if this interface were kind of rough and, you know, winding, or if we're the surface of a sphere or something, it's still some two-dimensional surface. But, you know, what Jeff Teo and Charlie Kane invited us to imagine is, well, what if this surface is kind of fluctuating and these things are really moving in three dimensions? Okay. So that is a little scary. Because then you have to ask, well, what happens if these things are permuted? It certainly looks like you'll have some kind of higher dimensional representation. You have this large Hilbert space, 2 to the n minus 1 dimensional. And it, on the other hand, it's clearly not a product of local Hilbert spaces, since you have roughly square root of 2 states per particle. So that looks like it might be in conflict with what we know. Okay. And to make matters worse, they showed that when you exchange two of these hedgehogs, okay, you get essentially what you'd expect. You get a unitary transformation of the following form. The overall phase, let's not talk about that right now. But the main thing is that you have a unitary of this form, which essentially interchanges the two zero modes, is what you expect. You take two of these hedgehogs, you exchange them. Well, the zero mode should also be exchanged, and one of them picks up a minus sign. Okay. And to make things really bad, if you do two of these exchanges, well, unlike in the Bray group, where if you do two of these exchanges, of course, you still have a non-trivial Bray, here you do two of these exchanges, well, nothing has moved. And thus, even without moving the hedgehogs and, in effect, just twisting them, you're, again, imposing a non-trivial transformation. To give you another example of where this kind of problem may arise, there's been a lot of excitement recently about proposals of that start with the observation that if you have a superconducting wire with strong spin orbit coupling and in a parallel magnetic field, and you induce superconductivity in this wire, then there are Majorana fermion zero modes at the end of this wire. And there's beautiful work by actually Yuval Oreg and collaborators Jason Alicia and Matthew Fisher and various follow-up works that observe that you can make networks out of these wires, okay, and shuttle around these zero modes by applying gates. And of course, if you want to be able to move things past each other, it's useful to have 2D or quasi-2D networks, but there's no reason that you can't have a three-dimensional network. You could imagine a cubic lattice or any three-dimensional lattice like this in which you're shuttling around these Majorana zero modes by changing which regions have topological and non-topological superconductivity, and again, you're faced with moving around Majorana zero modes in three dimensions. And the same problem is going to arise. So the first thing you have to ask about is, well, are these unitary transformations due to Teo and Kane? Well, first of all, is it correct? Okay. And actually, it obviously the calculations in their paper are correct, but it's even easier to show that it's obviously correct, which is that if you exchange two defects supporting zero modes, well, you certainly expect those zero modes to be interchanged. Now, the only non-trivial part is the minus sign, which is what makes this thing non-abelian, and well, that minus sign has to be there if you want to conserve fermion parity. Okay. So just the fact of interchange and conservation of fermion parity really forces you into this. So anytime you have some kind of Majorana zero modes in higher dimensions, you know, such as the wire networks, if you can move them around and interchange them, you're going to get something like this, okay, so long as you're conserving fermion parity. Okay. So this is a very serious and general problem anytime you have something in higher dimensions with zero modes like this. Okay. So, and you know, really we don't have any wiggle room now, so we have to face up to some questions such as, well, you know, in two dimensions, we understand where these unitary transformations come from. And in two dimensions, actually that phase, which I kind of left unspecified, is some fixed thing, which in the case of Ising anions is actually pi over 8. And these unitary transformations, well, why do they arise? Well, they're some particular representation of the Braid group, okay? Or the n-particle version of this, if you fix a number of particles, is a representation of the n-particle Braid group. But in 3D, if we get basically the same or similar transformations, you know, what's the group that they're representing? Okay, so in a sense, we have the, you know, in 2D, we have the question, which is what's an interesting representation of the Braid group, and here's one, or the simplest interesting representation. But in 3D, we have the answer, but we don't know what the question is. You know, what's the group that this is representing? Okay. And to put this in slightly different terms, how do we resolve this apparent contradiction with the conventional wisdom about two dimensions versus three dimensions? And the way we go about trying to solve that is you would ask, well, what is the configuration space of 2n hedgehogs? What is its first homotopy group? Does it, and if so, why does it have non-trivial, non-abelian representations? If this turned out to just be the permutation group, as it is, as you might naively expect it to be, it doesn't have any non-trivial, non-abelian representations consistent with locality. Okay. Now, there's a hint here, which was explained already in the paper of Teo and Kane, which is that, you know, hedgehogs are not really point-like, okay, which would force you into the permutation group. On the other hand, it's not like, you know, we're completely throwing out the permutation group and the three-dimensionality. They're not really, it's not lines either, okay? So it's not like you're taking some lines and exchanging them around each other, which would really lead you right back to the Braid group. It's somehow intermediate between those two cases. Okay, so it's not a simple explanation like that. And another question you might ask, which I'll explain the motivation for this question later, is, well, can the elementary excitations in 3D be non-abelian anions? So before proceeding, there's one minor techno point which I have to, you know, take care of, which I unfortunately don't have time to describe in more detail, but would be happy to talk about later if people are interested, which is that, you know, all these models, you know, there's Teo Kane and the Majorana wire networks, and another model that I will briefly describe later, which we call basically the fermion dimer model. Well, these are all examples of fully gapped free fermion systems. Now, of course, a superconductor is not a free fermion system, but if once you specify an order parameter up to some interactions which are actually irrelevant, it is essentially a free fermion system for fixed values of the order parameters and other parameters in the Hamiltonian. Now, there's a general classification of such systems, due to some people who are in the audience. The space of three-dimensional Hamiltonians with no symmetries, which is sometimes called class D, is a space of Hamiltonians in which you can think of the Hamiltonian as being a matrix in the coset space of UN mod ON with N large. Okay. So rather than thinking about this as just a superconducting order parameter, the real and imaginary components, together with this Dirac mass, which if you fix the magnitude, and assuming that the gap is not going to go to zero, if you assume that the gap is non-zero, and you don't really care topologically about the magnitude of the gap, so you can just fix the magnitude of the gap and have a vector pointing up whose tip lies on the surface of the two-sphere, if you consider this more generally, don't restrict to one band, for instance, allow all possible order parameters consistent with the symmetries, then really you should think of the Hamiltonian as being parameterized by a mass term, which doesn't lie on the surface of the sphere, but rather lies on the surface of, or rather lies in this coset space, okay, with n large. Okay. For n sufficiently large, the topology is independent of n. Okay. And in this coset space, point-like defects, the second homotopy group, which classifies point-like defects in three dimensions, it's not z, the integers, as it would be for the sphere, which would allow all winding numbers of the sphere, but it's actually z2. Okay. So we don't actually have hedgehogs, double hedgehogs, triple hedgehogs, negative hedgehogs, and so on. We just have a z2 classification, okay, of these hedgehogs. Now, for the purpose of drawing pictures and sometimes for talking about it, it's very useful to use this n equals 2 case as shorthand, so sometimes I'll do that, but in fact, we really are talking about point-like defects classified by z2. Okay. So let me give a, so now in trying to understand the answer to the question, which is, you know, what's the group which is being represented here, let me give a heuristic description of the answer, okay, before sketching out how it's derived. So it was already recognized in the work of Teo and Kane, basically following some older work of Wilczek and Z on one lower dimension, looking at the nonlinear sigma model with topological terms in one lower dimension, that a very nice way of summarizing the topology of these order parameter configurations is to study the pre-images of the North Pole. Okay, so again, I'm kind of telling a white lie here by describing it as if the order parameter lies on the surface of the sphere. It's really in UN mod ON, but I'll draw the pictures this way and just keep in the back of your mind that we're really talking about U mod O. Well, if you look at the pre-images of the North Pole, they certainly include the hedgehogs, right? Because the hedgehog has every direction, so it will at least include the North Pole. And, yes?
Sorry,
go ahead.
Can you remind us what's a pre-image?
Oh, yeah. So, thank you for asking the question. So, at every point in space, you have some value of the order parameter, okay? And so the order parameter, every value, at every point in space, you have a map from, let's say, R3 to the surface of the, well, not really the surface of the sphere, but let's say the surface of the sphere. So the pre-image is all the points at which the order parameter points to the North Pole. Okay. Which if you think physically back, it's all the points where the supernetting order parameter is zero and the mass is positive. Okay. So a hedgehog's, all the hedgehogs certainly include, are certainly included in the pre-image because the hedgehog is where you have the order parameter pointing in every direction. Right. So it certainly includes the hedgehogs. And it, in fact, it's framed, and if you just compare the dimension of three-dimensional space to the two-dimensional surface of the sphere, it's a mismatch of one, which tells you the pre-image has to be arcs. It has to be one-dimensional manifolds, possibly with boundaries. So what you have are the set of points which get mapped to the North Pole is some closed loops as well as some arcs connecting the hedgehogs. Okay, so, so that, that's what's meant by the pre-image. Okay, good. So in addition, okay, you have a map from R3 to the surface of the sphere. You actually also have maps from, at each point, the tangent space of R3 to the tangent space of the sphere. And if you consider a vector in that tangent space, you can pull that back so that you have, at each point here as well, a vector in the tangent space.
Okay. So I can just think of that as another, take another, the pre-image of another point. Sort of close by.
Infinitesimally, yes. You can think of it as, you can think of it as two infinitesimally close by points, if you wish. Yeah.
So in physical terms, this is the part of a vortex line which is in the topological insulator. And the detection is like a phase of the order parameter locally. Okay.
Okay. So good. So, so we're kind of keeping track of these lines as a way of summarizing. You know, we have all this very complicated information here because we've got these defects and we've got this very complex order parameter configuration interpolating between those defects. And this is some way of summarizing that and drawing simpler pictures than drawing an arrow everywhere. Okay. Now, so consider what happens when two of these hedgehogs, following Teo and Kane, really, what happens when two of these hedgehogs are exchanged. Well, now, a warning here. This actually looks very similar to pictures, those braiding pictures I drew earlier. And those braiding pictures I drew earlier, this vertical direction was the time direction. That's not what's happening here. There's no, time is depicted by going from one picture to another. So you should think of this as looking at a roll of film, you know, 24 frames per second, and you're going from one frame to the next. So this is kind of a movie, if you wish. And so this up direction is just one of the spatial directions. And, you know, this is time zero, and this is some later time, you know, time one. And when two hedgehogs are exchanged, what happens is you exchange these two hedgehogs, and you go from a picture like this to a picture like this. Okay. Now you can see when you do that, that the order parameter in between has not, although the hedgehogs have returned to the exact same positions you had them before with these four hedgehogs here, the order parameter in between has been disturbed, and you've left something behind. You've left behind that disturbance, which is the fact that these arcs here are not the same as they were before. Okay. Yeah.
Could you just move the lines also? Like,
yeah. So we have to do more. Yeah. So we need to also move the lines in order to continue, in order to get back. So what I'm saying is, if you just move the hedgehogs and don't heal the order parameter in between, which is those lines, then you're not returned to the same point. And we want to study loops in configuration space, so we need to start and end at the exact same point in configuration space. So like you said, like Rahul said, we need to keep going, basically. Okay. So we must restore the arcs. And one way of, there's various ways of drawing this, one way to draw that restoration is to pull down these two bits of the arc over here, and then suture them, cut and rejoin them. Okay. The reason I'm drawing it this way, which seems a little pedantic, is you notice that what I said earlier is that we should think of these loops as having an arrow pointing off of them, so maybe you want to think of them as ribbons. And then having said that, I'm not drawing ribbons, I'm just drawing arcs, okay? Because it's just easier to draw. I think maybe the next version of PowerPoint should just have like a ribbon as just one of the types of things you can put in. But so anyway, the reason I'm drawing this way is, although I haven't drawn ribbons, I've kept track of these kinks that are put in, which is really the point of the ribbon, is to keep track of these little twists. So by drawing it this way, slightly pedantically, I don't lose track of those ribbons, and I do this surgery. You can see that this one is twisted, and so to heal it up, again, following Teo and Kane, you need to twist this one, okay, to undo that twist. So really, a looping configuration space is an exchange, some surgery of these ribbons, and then finally a twist on the end. Okay. So did that kind of mesh with what you were asking about? Good. So now, of course, a counterclockwise exchange is the same as a clockwise exchange in three dimensions. So which way I'd done it wouldn't matter, but different possible ways of healing the order parameter aren't equivalent. So for instance, if I did that exchange just as before, and again, it doesn't matter whether it's clockwise or counterclockwise, but instead of kind of pinching down on the right, I pinched down on the left and healed the order parameter over here, then this is a different, this is a different history. It's a different loop in configuration space, although it turned out it's actually just the inverse of the previous one. Okay. So it turns out that if we want to think about this group, it's generated by these primitive processes, which are an interchange, it can be either clockwise or counterclockwise, doesn't matter, together with a healing of the order parameter in between. Okay. And the other way of healing it is just the inverse.
Okay. Yeah. Do I see that it's the only thing, that these two are the only things which are necessary?
I'll tell you that later. When I'm doing this in the opposite order, I'm telling you the answer first, and I'll tell you why later. Okay. Okay. So usually a permutation squares to one. Okay. Here, that's not quite true, okay? Because if I square this thing, remember, it's not equal to its own inverse. If I square this, then I end up doing this, okay, which isn't one. You can't take this sequence of pictures, you can't take this movie here and deform it continuously into the movie where nothing happens. So if we wanted to, we could call this x, okay, which is just a square of something. Now, this thing, it turns out, actually can be, if you square it, can be undone. Basically, because if I square this, then each of these hedgehogs undergoes a 4-pi twist, and you know the usual thing about a 4-pi twist. So a 2-pi twist you can't undo, but then a 4-pi twist can be undone. So these operations, although they don't square to one as in the permutation group, their fourth power is equal to one. Right. Now, distant t's commute with each other, which is if you're doing interchanges of you know, disjoint pairs of hedgehogs. They commute with each other. Furthermore, if you take any two of these squares, you know, any two of these double interchanges, they commute with each other. It's obvious that they will if you have disjoint pairs, but actually if you have an overlapping pair, that's still true, okay? So here's a movie, okay, a sequence of pictures in which I've depicted the left-hand side of this equation, which is xi, which is a double exchange on 1 and 2, or I and I plus 1, and a double chain exchange on I plus 1 and I plus 2. And the right-hand side is the opposite order of those double exchanges, and this is what we kind of jokingly call the movie of movies. So you should think of this sequence of pictures as like a movie, and it's a continuous deformation of this movie into this and this, and finally into the right-hand side of this equation. Okay. Now, these x's, they all commute with each other, they all square to 1, so they just form 2n minus 1 copies of z2, and all they do is they twist the particles, they don't, you know, permute them. Okay. Whereas the TIs involve both a twist and a permutation. And this, of course, doesn't need to commute with this, because if I take TI and XI and act with them, for instance, if I do a twist first and then a permutation, well, I can rewrite that as a permutation first, but then you have to twist not the same particle, you have to twist a permuted particle, right? So if I want to twist this one and then I do some permutation, well, I have to go over and twist, you know, where it moved to, right? And well, that structure, okay, which is really the most natural structure here, is the structure of a semi-direct product, okay? That they're not really independent, that when you do a permutation, you then have to do your other action on where something got permuted. So, you know, the elements, okay, and I'll answer your question, Anton, momentarily. So the elements you can understand of this group, you can understand as basically you can twist an even number of ribbons, okay? You can perform an even permutation, or you can twist an odd number of ribbons and perform an odd permutation. Okay, so the final answer, which I'll sketch, you know, where this comes from, is it's a semi-direct product between permutations of all these hedgehogs, a bunch of z2s, which is for twisting all of them, and this even part means that the combined parity has to be even. So if you do an even permutation, you don't have to do any twisting. Okay, if you do an even number of twists, you don't have to do any permuting. But if you do an odd number of either, you have to do both twisting and permuting. Okay. So you can draw pictures, and this is a very reasonable answer for what you expect, that you will be permuting and so on. And it's intuitively appealing. To show that it's actually correct is more difficult, more technical. Okay, I'll just give you kind of an outline of how this goes. So we can break this problem into smaller pieces, basically by decomposing this configuration space into building blocks. So the thing we're after, this thing we call K sub 2n, it's a configuration space of 2n defects. Well, it's the total space of a fibration, which means the following, which means that the way you can think about it is, you can think about, first of all, think of those hedgehogs as being like point particles, okay? They have more to them, but at least they have as much structure as point particles. And so they have at least a configuration space of 2n point particles. However, once you fix where those point particles are, you then also have to say how the order parameter interpolates between them, okay? Which we kind of summarize by drawing those arcs, but it's really just how the order parameter interpolates between them. So in essence, you can think of it as if for each point in the configuration space of 2n point particles, which is the base space, we have a fiber, which is the order parameter, which interpolates between these two n defects at fixed positions. Okay. Now, it's not, of course, just, it may locally look like, but it's not just a tensor product between configurations of point particles and of order parameters, because there's some topology to it, but, you know, which is what's kind of encapsulated in this notion of fibration. And the key property that it has is that we have an exact sequence, which means that you have a series of maps. So we have a series of maps such that the image of one map is the kernel of the other map, which is what we have here. Then the same thing, well, there's a long exact sequence then associated with the homotopy groups. So this is a mechanism by which, if you know some of the homotopy groups, you can deduce the others. Okay. So in particular, given this vibration, we know that there are maps between this configuration space of order parameters, the configuration space itself, the total configuration space, its first homotopy group, which is what we're interested in, and the configuration and the first homotopy group of the configuration space of point particles. Now, this configuration space of point particles is that homotopy group is actually the permutation group, right? Because that's just point particles. So we know from this already at this stage that the permutation group is going to be part of the answer. Okay. So there's, in other words, there's a map here from the order parameter configuration spaces, the first homotopy group of the order parameter configurations, whose image is the kernel of this map to the permutation group. Okay. Now, to make further progress, actually, we want to break this down even further. Okay. So, actually, this particular way of looking at it was sort of the quickest way to realize that the permutation group is part of the answer. It's not so. It's in a sense, it's kind of a diversion. To really make further progress, what you want to do is break the problem down to further pieces. So, we break the space down into a fibration in which we have configurations. Not point particles, but rather configurations in which you just have the kind of infinitesimal neighborhood of each of these point particles, which we're calling Y2n, and just the maps to U mod O in the neighborhood of those in the infinitesimal neighborhoods of the point particles. So it's sort of just kind of the local around the hedgehog, and then all the interpolation between these hedgehogs. Okay, so you can think of it like this: Y2n is sort of what the order parameter looks like in the vicinity of the hedgehogs in R2n, as well as their positional degree of freedom. And R2n is the order parameter connecting them up.
So, okay. So can I think of this as each hedgehog has an orientation, and it's that orientation that is...
Yeah, exactly. So another way you can think of it is each hedgehog is like a little bit of ribbon sticking out of it, which may have some twists. And R2n is the section of ribbon connecting the little stub of ribbon from each hedgehog to the stub of ribbon of another hedgehog. Yeah. Okay. And this can be further broken up to kind of remove the positional degree of freedom, which we know, of course, is just in the end is just the permutation going to give you the permutation group from those same little stubs of ribbons, but just for spheres at fixed positions. Okay, just for hedgehogs at fixed positions. So this is kind of a way of separating, first of all, the motion of the hedgehogs, which we know in the end is just going to lead to the permutation group, the twists of the hedgehogs locally, which we kind of know is just going to keep track of twisting number, and then the connections between the hedgehogs, which are the ribbons, okay, which is why where the R comes from, the ribbons, which is going to keep track of this fact that a 4π rotation can be undone, but 2π cannot. Okay. So we now have an exact sequence of fibrations like this, various pieces of which we can compute directly, and when you do that, you end up basically to what I showed you before. There turns out there's an extra overall Z2, and this is this thing we call the ribbon permutation group. So it's kind of an enhancement of the permutation group to include these twists, but there really isn't anything else beyond that. Oh, so again, this is a made-up notation, so it just means even part. So the combined parity of the permutation and of the twist has to be even.
Sorry. So what is this K2n tilde? Is this same as K2n or different?
Yeah, it's almost the same. We further broke this up. We removed, in U mod O, there's kind of a U1 piece. And then there's, so this is sort of imagining that we had, rather than U mod O, SP mod SO, and we kind of took care of the U1 piece later, separately.
It doesn't follow from anything that this is the only group which gives non-trivial, which gives interesting non-abelian.
Oh right, yeah, that doesn't follow. No, we're just trying to analyze this particular model.
Yeah. So in 2D, Braid group is the only one relevant for non-abelian statistics. Is that correct?
Well, I mean, the Braid group is the only one relevant for non-abelian statistics with point-like particles. You can see the reason you're getting something interesting here is that there's some additional structure that they're not quite point particles. And Actually, I don't know the answer in 2D if you have particles with some further structure, if you could get something other than the Bray group. I also don't know whether here, in this case, in three dimensions, if you had a different additional structure, could you get something interesting? I don't know the answer to that either. But, yeah. I mean, I think it's true, Warren, maybe you could correct me on this. I think that if the permutation group is part of the story, probably this is the only, in fact, this particular representation may be the only thing.
One simple generalization I could think of is putting a Z3 twist, for example, instead. Okay. I mean, the additional Z2 group which you have there, the twist, mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be Z2. It could have Z3. I mean, what discrete group you have there is not. I do not see why would Z2 appear on fundamental.
Doesn't the Z2 have something to do with rotation?
Yeah, the Z2 has to do with rotations, 2π and 4π rotations.
Actually, it has to do with the pi periodicity here, right? I mean, the space that is the target space for the configurations is one of the symmetric spaces in the Botlins that occurs in the Katari paper.
Okay.
So the homotopy groups are Z2, 0, and Z.
So there could be Z, for example.
There could be Z in other cases.
Yeah. No, well, I mean, I could imagine that you had some. I mean, you could cook up some order, some order parameter, such that it had some kind of underlying Z3 structure to it that somehow played into the configuration, the homotopy group configuration space. But I haven't. I haven't done that exercise.
Another example, imagine there is this Pitkovsky-Kitaev model, which has Z8 mm-hmm. classification of defects. Mm-hmm. So there, yes, it could. This dissertation could belong to the, it doesn't seem like there is no reason, because you have additional structure, and it doesn't seem like there is, or at least it's not immediately obvious what could specify this additional structure.
Well, no, here, I mean, I think this Z2 really is coming about from one way of thinking about it is 2π versus 4π rotations, right? This Z2 is just quick. Now,
rotation of the additional structure.
Yes, rotation of the additional structure, right. So I agree that the additional structure could have, could have some underlying symmetry.
It's the ribbons that have small triangles, kind of.
No, I understand. But this is for a rather large class, meaning you could probably come up with, you could impose some much higher symmetry. Here we really aren't imposing much in the way of symmetry, in the sense that this is a 3D system with no symmetry. We're allowing actually totally general Hamiltonians here, as long as you maintain the gap. Now, if you specialize, for instance, if you impose some additional global symmetries, you could probably fine tune it in such a way that you get some additional structure, but you wouldn't get anything as general as this. But I wouldn't rule it out. I mean, it probably is interesting to explore that.
Yeah, but yeah, I can say nothing mathematics here. So I think in principle, you can get all other, groups as well. I think one thing which is kind of can get lost of them is take any theory which has a finite image. Now that's a whole derivative of 2 to any prime number. And won't be the permutation group, will be like a dihedral group of something involved. So you just need to combine the two symmetries. So in principle, they all exist.
Yeah.
I don't know how to realize physically, but they all here.
Yeah.
Yeah. Where's the Z2 coming from? Like you said, the kernel of the projection. Presumably, that's the image of D2.
Mm-hmm.
When you say pi 1 of K2n, is the first term is the kernel of D1.
Yeah.
Second one should presumably be the image or the co-kernel of D2.
Mm-hmm.
But shouldn't I get Z2 to the 2n and not?
No, well, I think this Z2 is actually just the fact that, I think this is just handling for, even if this is, you can see this Z2 has nothing to do with the number of hedgehogs. And I think it's just the fact that you can have closed ribbons that look like this with no hedgehogs, right? And you can either have that twist or not have it.
I just don't follow it from the exact sequence. Go up there.
Okay. Why don't we touch base on that? Because actually, I don't want to run into your talk. Okay. So, Good. So, okay, so now I think we can answer at least that first question, which is if you have these matrices here, okay, and you want to know what group they're representing, okay, then this is the answer. It's a group generated by these T's, which satisfy some relations and have their fourth power equal to 1, so a little different than the permutation group as a result. Now, the pi over 8 is a two-dimensional answer. Let's just put a theta here, yes. Good. Now, of course, these braidless operations of T on K and V's are just the squares, okay? And they commute with each other, as we showed graphically in that picture, and as you can also see just from the structure of the group, this is actually the Z2, or this collection of Z2s, which are inside here. Now, of course, we'd like to identify a representation of this group with their generators, so we say that the matrix representing this Ti is this matrix with some theta that we don't know over here. Okay. So, of course, then what happens, of course, is these x's, there's a little bit of a surprise here because these x's are now represented by products of gammas, okay, again with some phase. And the reason this is surprising is if you look at this product of gammas, then if you have two overlapping pairs, then the representatives of these x's anti-commute, okay, whereas the x's themselves in the group actually commute. Okay. So this is not actually a linear representation of this group. It's what's called a projective representation, which is to say that the multiplication rule is only reproduced up to a phase. So a surprise has happened here, which is that unlike in the case of Ising anions, where we have the braid group, we have some representation of the braid group, that gives rise to Ising anions, here we have this ribbon permutation group, we have a representation of it, but it's not a linear representation, it's a projective representation. Right. Now, actually, the idea that you could have projective representations arising in particle statistics was first suggested about 10 years ago by Wilczek and criticized at that time correctly by Nick Reed, who said that, well, because that was projective representations of just the permutation group, and that'll violate locality, okay, as you can see by this kind of Alice and Bob little Gedanken experiment, which is supposing you have some permutation, sigma 1 and sigma 3, which anti-commute, even though 1 and 2 are far from 3 and 4. Then what Alice can do is prepare an initial state, which is a spin in the x direction, and perform the permutation if the spin is up and do nothing if the spin is down, a little bit before 0, and then perform a second operation, which is do the permutation in the opposite case, a little after 0, and then finally do a permutation at some later time, and you can see this permutation will undo the permutation that you did either here or here. Okay, so basically nothing will happen to this auxiliary spin, and you get back to the initial state, okay, at late times, unless Bob, who was far away, performed a sigma 3 permutation, okay, at some times in between the two times that Alice did her measurements, okay. And if they anti-commute, then in fact, Alice is going to end up with the spin in the negative x direction rather than the x direction. So if we just have, if we just try to have particles which realize projective representations of just the permutation group, we'd run into trouble with locality. Okay? So that's not going to work.
But there is already trouble with locality in your problem anyway because of the ribbons.
Yeah, right. So our problem, we don't have this problem. There's no problem with locality because our particles are never in spatially disjoint regions because of the ribbons that are connecting them, right? So good. We don't have to worry about that locality issue, okay? Now, let me ask a slightly different question, which is there some way to get rid of the ribbons, okay, which would really make this issue sharper? Well, even the best case scenario is that the system really were maximally symmetric, meaning that it had this mu mod O, was an actual symmetry of the problem rather than just the topology of the classifying space. Well, there would still be a linear confining force between the defects. I mean, if you just put in a gradient type of term for the order parameter, that's going to give you a linear confining force between the defects. And in general, in any case, you don't really have that full symmetry, so you would have perhaps a bigger, you know, linear confining force between them. Okay, so.
So are you suggesting that there is actually a reason from this sort of an argument why you could explain that these defects are confined?
Well, yeah. So what this argument is saying is that in the best case scenario, there's a linear confining force between these defects. Okay, which is in the best case scenario is the case in which it was maximally symmetric which had this huge symmetry group, even then, just a gradient energy would give you a confining force. So there's no sense in this model in which you can, I mean, the ribbons are always there. These particles are never really in spatially disjoint regions, okay? So this issue of locality from the previous slide isn't going to arise in this model, even if we allowed, you know, fluctuations of the order parameter.
So okay? Could you conclude that somehow if you had this projective representation, then the particles have to be confined?
No. So let's talk about that. So that's what I want to talk about now. Okay. So maybe not is the answer. So so the overall phase. Okay. So but let me just make one more comment, which is at some kind of intuitive level, although I don't really know how to make a precise connection. You know, we had this projective representation arising where kind of the overall phase wasn't being faithfully represented from the group to the representation. Maybe part of the reason is because the overall phases really aren't topological invariants. You're not ever in a situation in which all you have is statistics and everything else is exponentially decaying, all other interactions. You always have some strong interaction, which doesn't affect, in a sense, the non-abelian, perhaps, the overall kind of matrix, but the phases perhaps are being, you know, screwed up by that. Okay. That's not really a precise statement. That's just kind of an intuitive, well, it's an observation which may be related to why a projective representation is arising here. Okay. So then let's basically ask the question that Charlie asked, which is, okay, so this is, at least in this model, this is what we have. Is there some way to get rid of this confining force, which is to say, you know, can we have some system in which these non-abelian particles in 3D were just weakly coupled quasi-particles of the system?
What's the confining force in this
LK? Linear.
What is it physically? When you have just the agent which are topologically insulated, then
yeah. Well, it's just the gradient energy.
You have to imagine that the mass, the thing that makes it a topological insulator or a trivial insulator becomes a dynamical degree of freedom.
Yeah.
In addition to the superconducting orbital parameter.
Right.
And then it's the gradients in that which can
help the energy for changing.
Okay. Okay, so can we get rid of this? Well, one approach you might try is to say, well, let's just gauge the order parameter in order to get rid of this long-range force. So if we're saying it's all coming from gradient energy, well, let's just gauge it. Okay, so make all these derivatives into covariant derivatives, introduce a gauge field for that symmetry, and then this becomes also covariant derivatives. The hedgehog now becomes a Toth-Polyakov monopole. But actually, the resulting gauge theory is sick. It suffers some anomaly. So configurations with different fermion number would have to be gauge invariant. This is something called the Witten anomaly. So curing the anomaly, the way to cure it is by doubling the number of fermions. And that also eliminates the Majorana zero modes. Rather than Majorana zero mode, you have a pair of them at each hedgehog. And so you've lost that. Okay. So at least this particular way of doing it doesn't seem like a no-go. Okay. Well, let's imagine something a little different. Let's suppose the order parameter were disordered by quantum fluctuations, okay, while maintaining a finite gap for the hedgehog. So the core energy of the hedgehog is remaining finite, but the order parameter, which had a stiffness before, well, it's fluctuating a lot, so maybe that, we're, imagine that this is fluctuating and that stiffness is going away. Well, a way to describe that is, let's suppose we represent this order parameter dynamics by a CP1 model, so rather than treat it as a vector, a three-component unit vector, we'll represent that by a two-component complex spinner, and with an overall constraint that its magnitude is 1, and a gauge field here, which is there to remove that unphysical U1 degree of the U1 degree of freedom, which is not present in the vector. Okay. And this model, if we just look at this model itself for the dynamics of the order parameter, has an ordered phase in which the Z condenses, in which hedgehogs and monopoles are confined. And in this language, that's just the strings that you have, or the flux tubes that you have between monopoles, which confine the monopoles. Okay. But there's also a disordered phase in which the expectation value of Z equals 0. And then, of course, this gauge field becomes gapless, and the monopoles interact via a gapless photon. Okay. And so one approach that you might want to consider is to take this system and then couple it to the fermions. Okay. Well, if we do that, we couple something like this, a fermion. So this is our initial, this is that order parameter dynamics I just described. You can couple it to the fermions. And then if you want to disorder this order parameter while maintaining that fermion gap, what you might imagine is rotating the fermions so they're kind of in the local frame of the order parameter. You can then essentially decouple up to gradients the fermions from the order parameter dynamics. And now when z is disordered, you integrate z out. And what it looks like you get is just basically QED, okay, in 3+1 dimensions, although, of course, the masses and velocities are all different. Okay. So it looks like this leads you to a theory, but with a price, which is that it's not a fully gapped theory. You have a gapless photon in the theory. Okay. So it looks like, at least by this route, if you want to get rid of that long-range confining force, you have gapless excitations in the bulk, which, of course, is unlike what we had and what you sort of don't, perhaps don't want. And secondly, the force, it's not an exponentially decaying force between the monopoles. It's a 1 over r. But actually, did you have a question?
Does this couple the degrees of freedom of the Meyer Heiser lens?
No, it doesn't. But something else does that I'm about to describe. Okay, so this doesn't. Okay, but.
Didn't understand this part. So where these fermions come from?
These fermions are the underlying fermions of the model. So if you just go back a few, let me go back a couple slides. If we go back to the original TLK model, what is it? It's fermions moving in the presence of a Dirac mass and superconducting order parameter, okay, which I'm combining into this order parameter n. And what we're now doing is we're allowing some quantum dynamics for that order parameter. So it's the same fermions, okay? Now, we're going, through a bunch of steps, and these fermions here are basically the same fermions, but rotated to the local direction. So we're imagining there's some local ordering of the order parameter, but no long-range coherence. Okay, you could just as well, if you wish, take the original fermions and introduce some slave particles, which these are the slave particles, like slave fermions, and the slave bosons, which are not condensing, are the fluctuating order parameter, if you wish. Okay. Now, there's an additional complication, okay? So what I just described isn't quite right, okay? And to see this, it's very helpful to look at the ordered phase, okay? Go back to the ordered phase and observe that there's a topologically non-trivial configuration, which is to say, remember, the ordered phase, you have a unit vector in three dimensions. Well, there's an order parameter configuration in which at far away at infinity, the order parameter just points up, okay, let's say at the north pole, and winds around in the interior such that it has non-trivial Hopf number. Okay. Another way of saying that is if the order parameter it points to one very far away, okay, then you know the energy is finite because it's only different from a constant. The energy you worry about is gradient energy, it's only different from a constant in some finite region. Okay, and so it's then you can think of as a map from, if you compactify three-dimensional space, it's a map from the three-sphere to the two-sphere, okay, and that there are non-trivial maps, okay, classified by Hopf number. Okay, and you can see what this configuration looks like is in the middle, it points to the north pole and far away. Out at some distance, it points to the south pole, and then in between those two, it's pointing in the plane and winding around like this. Okay. Now, it was observed in a paper by Yingran, and collaborators that actually this configuration, is in this model is actually fermionic. Okay, because of the coupling to fermions, when you have a non-trivial topological defect like this, it's a fermion. You could, for instance, since there's a gap to the fermions, you could integrate out the fermions and get a topological term, which they did in their paper. And computing that topological term, you can show that these quantities are fermions, which is to say, if you create a pair of these, exchange or twist one of them, and then recombine, you get a minus sign. Okay. Now, the thing that's interesting is when the order parameter is disordered, we believe that this fermion becomes gapless, actually. Okay. Kind of a heuristic back of the envelope way to see that this ought to happen is if you look at this configuration, it's given by a spinner like this, and if you then write the corresponding gauge field associated with that spinner according to the constraints and substitute into just the magnetic field energy, you get an energy which decreases as you make the Hopfion larger. Okay. So ordinarily, in the ordered phase, there's a stiffness, so there's a grad n squared term, and as a result of that stiffness, you prefer to have smaller Hopfions. The energy gets larger as the thing gets larger, just on dimensional grounds, so it wants to squeeze down and it becomes some like lattice scale Hopfion is lowest in energy. Okay. But when you don't have any stiffness, when the only remnant of stiffness is actually the Maxwell energy for the gauge field, actually the reverse happens. The energy gets lower the bigger it gets, so a Hopfion that's the size of the entire system is going to be lower in energy by the semi-classical argument. Okay.
So basically the argument is that these Hopfions carry units of fermion parity.
Yeah, and they're dapless.
They're floating around freely, so they can take fermion parity from
exactly.
one on into another.
Exactly. Now on the other hand, if the Hopfions, you know, by this argument, actually their energy goes inversely with system size. So if they have a relativistic spectrum, okay, then actually the zero modes aren't destabilized, although they can carry fermion number from one to another just on phase space grounds. What they would introduce is a decay rate to the zero modes that goes as temperature T squared. Okay, so there's just in three dimensions, if you have a Dirac spectrum, the coupling to a localized defect is irrelevant. And so there's obviously they can carry away, but there would be some kind of power law type of protection to these zero modes. Okay. And as Charlie was just saying, you can think of these as carrying these Hopfions as carrying around fermion parity, and that's actually a very useful way to think about it, which is to say you can think of, if you just want to twist one of these defects, don't do a double twist or twist in a permutation, but just twist one of them. Well, you can twist one, and you act with this operator gamma I on that one, but then you also, if you twist one, then remember, fermion parity is like I gamma 1 gamma 2, and if you twist one and just take gamma 1 to minus gamma 1, well then, okay, that's, you know, that would violate fermion parity, so you would have to admit a Hopfion, which you can do at zero energy. So a rotation you can think of as just twisting one and emitting a Hopfion, and if you just do an, yeah?
These Hopfions, does it find identity of them, or should we think of them as a...
Well, you should think of it, well, okay, so we can't prove that you should think of them as a Dirac point. The argument about energetics that I gave makes it very natural that they're a Dirac point. I'll give a slightly different argument. Okay. So if that's correct and you just think of it as a Dirac point, then there's not a finite density of them. Okay.
How do they get this energy in order to create them?
Well, they do, but the energy, at least semi-classically, that energy, and I'll give you a more quantum mechanical version as well, but semi-classically, the energy gets lower the larger they are. The energy grows, it decreases. No, there's no core. See, that's the thing. This is a perfectly smooth configuration. Let me show you what it looks like. See, there's no core here. It's a completely smooth configuration. Right at the origin, it's pointing up just as it is far away. So it's not a hedgehog. See, that's the thing. A hedgehog really has a core because it's discontinuous. But these things don't have a core. Yeah. So it's all gradient energy. Yeah. So and then you can think of, if you just do a permutation without any twisting, you can think of that as acting with gamma I and gamma j and emitting a Hopfion. And then the combined twist and permutation, you know, basically emitting and reabsorbing a Hopfion to get you this kind of thing. So we don't have the ribbons anymore, okay? We have Coulomb interactions and photons, but that actually is unimportant as far as the, you know, the exchanging and statistics is concerned. It's really the gapless Hopfion that's crucial as far as the statistics is concerned, because that's what replaces the ribbon when you get rid of the ribbon is the gapless fermions that enable you to keep track of the Hopfion, in essence, keeps track of twists and permutations and enforces this. Okay. Now, in just the last few minutes, that clock's not really right,
is it?
Maybe it is. So in just the last few minutes, let me mention a microscopic model where some of this, where this physics basically arises, which we believe is in this phase. So it's essentially a quantum dimer model, the Rockser-Kivelson model. So it has a term in here which says, you think of so dimers are degrees of freedom that live on the lengths of a lattice. Let's just take it to be the cubic lattice. And And there's a rule that says that you only want one dimer touching each site. So you can have a dimer here, but then you can't have one on any of the other links touching that site. So it's a dimer model. That's what you mean by dimer model. Then there's free fermions. Okay, so we'll imagine there's one Majorana degree of freedom at each vertex of this lattice. Okay, but 8 per unit cell, for reasons I'll explain momentarily. So we're not assuming Majoranas from the beginning. And these can hop around from site to site of the cubic lattice according to the following rules. They can only hop between two sites if there's a dimer there. And so the Majoranas, sorry, there really should be an I here as well. And there has to be a sign for that hopping. And that sign is given by a matrix which basically enforces the pi flux rule. So if you take a product of these m's around any plaquette, you get minus 1. Okay. So if all the n's were equal to 1, which they obviously can't because you can only have one dimer touching each site, but if they were, then you would just have fermions hopping in pi flux. Okay, but they can't, and in fact, for some dimer configurations, for instance, if I just put in a columnar configuration, then they would be stuck just moving between these two sites. Okay, but we allow the dimers to move around. Okay, and that's what puts some interesting dynamics in there. And the dynamics is actually just the dynamics of the Rotzer-Kivelson model, which is anytime you have two parallel dimers, they can resonate and switch like this. Okay, on a plaquette. Now, when dimers, in the ordinary dimer model, that's all you have to say. But in this model, if you just move the dimers, okay, then you would also, if you're not careful, you would screw up fermion parity. So what we also have to do is we also swap the fermion degrees of freedom in such a way as to preserve fermion parity. Okay. So basically, this term in Hamiltonian is designed so that the dimers move around, and as the dimers resonate, the fermions kind of stay in their ground state relative to that particular hopping problem for that configuration of dimers. Okay, it's a completely artificial cooked up model for a purpose, so we're just going to go with it. Okay, and basically, we now use the fact that the Rotzer-Kivelson model in 3 dimensions has a Coulomb phase, okay, which we believe is exactly that Coulomb phase I describe in the effective field theory. It's exactly soluble right at the Rotzer-Kivelson point, actually. You can find the ground state exactly. And right at that RK point, Hopfions are gapless. So the Hopfion is a particular configuration of dimers, which I can draw for you, which is topologically non-trivial, and which is how it costs zero energy, okay, right at the RK point. And we believe as you move into the Coulomb phase, which is adjacent to the RK point, it remains gapless.
Right at the RK point, can we prove that a Hopfion are gapless?
Yes. Oh, yeah, so that's trivial because right at the RK point, you know that the ground state is a sum over all possible dimer configurations. The Hopfion is also an allowed dimer configuration, which is not connected by any plaquette move, so it's a degenerate state. No. Okay, so just to wrap up then, and I can show that to you in more detail if you're interested. So, you know, so defects in 3D systems can have Majorana zero modes. This isn't purely a two-dimensional phenomenon, and is actually they're interesting physical contexts, you know, which this does occur. These defects have non-trivial statistics in quotation mark, which realize a projective representation of the fundamental group of the multi-defect configuration space. So this is kind of an extra purely quantum mechanical minus one that I don't know that it's occurred in a context like this before. And such particles can be deconfined, but there's a cost here, which is you have gapless stage field interactions and gapless bulk fermions. Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay, any more questions?
Yeah. What about this billion part of the phase in the three-dimensional case? Is it completely free to be determined by different or?
Yeah, so I don't. We did not determine it, so I don't know. In fact, I don't even know if that phase is well defined in the three-dimensional case, because the two three-dimensional cases in which it might be relevant, one of them is just a long-range confining interaction. So, you know, there's no limit in which you can take those particles far enough apart such that you can isolate that abelian phase from just the dynamical phase. And you know, if we deconfine them, then we have the same problem still because we have gapless excitations and you know, gapless fermions even. So, yeah.
Jen, what about the last bullet point? So do you think there's an interesting open problem around that?
Yeah, so, okay. So of course, there is an interesting open problem, which is there some way to have a fully gapped problem? So we kind of went from confined to Coulomb. Is there a phase with exponentially decaying, you know, purely exponentially decaying correlation between them in three dimensions, which, you know, which has such particles? And, you know, the article, you know, the locality argument and kind of the way the ribbon system came about makes you think that that's unlikely, but, you know.
Maybe you can show that it's unlikely, that it's impossible.
It would be nice to show that it's impossible, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, Joel.
I don't have a non-interacting picture of Fibonacci anions, but does the mathematics look like it would allow you to do the same kind of thing with some sort of defect picture of those connected by a ribbon? So really, only Ising would have this 3D.
You know, the permutation group, you can see that the structures of the permutation group really came. It's kind of some enhancement or decoration of the permutation group. And so that's, you know, it's a finite group. The representation matrices form, you know, their image is finite. That's just not the case with Fibonacci anions. In a sense, the reason Fibonacci anions are so, would be so nice for quantum computing is that they would give you a universal quantum computer. And that could never come out of something like this.
Because it really is ultimately the permutation group.
Yeah.
I mean, for the same reason you can't do the Fibonacci ones in one dimension, right?
Yeah, I mean,
you can't do the quantum wire version of Fibonacci. Yeah.
So back to the RK point. So the RK point is superposition of all the diagonal calculations. Yeah. It's also like superposition of all the number of Hopkins.
Well, it's not superposition. You see, the dynamics doesn't connect different Hopfian numbers.
Oh, okay.
So that's different sectors. That's different ground state sectors that you have. Even if you have no, see, ordinarily you think of the different sectors as corresponding to different winding numbers if you're on a torus. But supposing the space is just the sphere, then you still have non-trivial topology from different Hopfian numbers, and those are just different sectors. Which, right at the RK point, are all degenerate in energy.
I see.
I should say one other thing. When I say all different Hopfian numbers, actually, I mean, in this dimer model, there's only a Z2 invariant for Hopfians, it turns out. I can show you what it is. It turns out there's a Z2 invariant. We don't quite have a Z invariant for Hopfians, so.
The Z would be setting capital N equal to 2, right?
Yeah. Okay. Well, it froze up. Anyway, I'll show you. The Z invariant is basically you construct a matrix, you know, the matrix that we have. Or maybe I should turn the light on. If you construct that matrix, if you define a matrix, which is, you know, 1 or 0, depending whether there's a dimer there, and then when it's 1, it's either plus 1 or minus 1, depending on the signs given by that pi flux. Well, it's basically the Pfaffian of this matrix. It's either plus or minus 1. That determines whether or not you have Hopfian number 0 or 1 for the dimer model. So that's actually an invariant of just the three-dimensional dimer model, the ordinary 3D dimer model with no fermions or whatever, which actually, as far as we know, never appeared in the literature before. So that's, if you wish, it's a new invariant of just the dimer model, which has a very nice interpretation when you put in fermions that invariant, you know, is this Hopfian.
Okay, any other questions? Let's thank Jen again.